Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The new movie, the new hit movie, Inception, got me thinking about dreams. So to set the mood for this discussion, let's hear a segment from the trailer of the movie. This is Leonardo DiCaprio.
There's one thing you should know about me. I specialize in a very specific type of security. Subconscious security.
You're talking about dreams.
We create the world of the dream. We bring the subject into that dream, and they fill it with their secrets.
Then you break in and steal it.
Well, it's not strictly speaking legal.
Director Christopher Nolan says the story, the idea that dreams can be shared, legally or not, is just an idea. But a guest coming up later, former journalist, novelist, and commentator Robert Moss believes that interactive or social dreaming may go on in our lives every night. And he's written extensively on that topic, and we're going to talk about that with him later. Joining us now is award-winning science writer Andrea Rock. She's the author of The Mind at Night, The New Science of How and Why We Dream. Welcome to the show, Andrea.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Have you seen the movie?
Yes, actually. I saw it this weekend and thought it was very interesting. Certainly some wonderful visual images as well.
Yeah, I always love the special effects. Mm-hmm. You write about lucid dreams in your book, The Mind at Night. And at the start of one chapter, you quote a 4th century B.C. Taoist philosopher describing a dream as a butterfly, and that when he awoke, he didn't know if he was Chang Zhu, I think that's how you pronounce it, dreaming that he was a butterfly, or whether he was now a butterfly dreaming that he is Chang Zhu.
Right. I think that lucid dreaming is a phenomenon in which you're able to actually be aware of the fact that you're dreaming in the midst of the dream and have the ability to direct the course of the dream just to some extent. And there was a lot of scientific skepticism about that initially, but there's no question that it does occur in REM sleep, and they've done all kinds of tests showing that a lucid dreamer is able to signal when he becomes lucid, and you can see that on the scientific equipment that's being used to record what's happening in the brain. So it's a fascinating thing. But the main function of dreaming, I mean, there are many fascinating functions for it, just in terms of our daily lives, even if you're not aware of it when it's going on.
Dream lore goes back as long as we can figure in history, but you started your book with the birth of dream research in the 1950s. Why was that?
That was when there was the first scientific evidence that there was a period of sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, occurring in which the whole sort of setup in the brain changed. You would see that what we know now is that the portion of the brain that's basically responsible for logical thinking and forward planning and so on kind of shifts down into low gear, and the chemical that's circulating in the brain changes so that it's one that enhances our ability to make connections that don't involve analytical reasoning, and the brain is kind of physiologically geared to make free-form associations that our waking mind would normally reject, you know, that you're in a bus flying over the ocean and Abe Lincoln is driving the bus or something, mm-hmm. and you accept that as perfectly logical. And that's one of the reasons that there are a lot of scientists and mathematicians, artists and so on, who report that solutions that didn't come to them in waking hours have come to them during dreams. One of the more well-known ones in terms of artist is Paul McCartney, describing that he first heard the tune for the song Yesterday being played by a string ensemble in a dream right before he woke up one morning. But since he had actually dreamed the music and it was so completely formed, he didn't believe for quite a while that it was actually his, and finally accepted that and came up with lyrics for the song. So that's one kind of change that occurs in the brain, but as they did further research, they began to see that what it looks like is that REM sleep evolved first in animals back on like 140 million years ago as a means of rehearsing processing new survival-related information from each day's experience and kind of rehearsing survival-related planning, you know, like running up the tree to escape a predator or, oh, those red berries make you sick, don't eat them again. And then there's been recent scientific evidence showing that, you know, birds mentally rehearse and practice their singing during sleep.
really?
And also another one in which rats who were learning during waking hours how to travel through a maze to get food rewards later would go through a rerun of that experience mentally when they entered dreaming sleep. And there was such a precise match in the pattern of their brain cells that fired when they were in the maze and when they were just dreaming about it that you could pinpoint, you know, exactly where they were in the dream. So all of those important functions, you know, that dreams fulfill for animals, you know, the dreaming phase of sleep are there for humans. But layered on top of it for us, of course, is the emotionally charged memories are what seem to be really targeted for processing during the dream phase of sleep.
My guest is Andrea Rock, science journalist and author of The Mind at Night, The New Science of How and Why We Dream. If you have a question or comment for Andrea, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post it there. Andrea, REM isn't the only time we dream, is it? I thought I read that it's not exactly – it's the best time that we dream.
It's one, the most active, but there are other stages of sleep that all have different functions where our brain is processing information. There are, you know, some stages of sleep that are important for learning new physical skills, others that help in memorization and so on. And then there's, you know, sort of in between deep dreaming and just sort of a light dreaming phase as you're first going to sleep. But some of the most interesting evidence, I think, suggests that dreaming really does serve as a form of nightly internal therapy that helps regulate your mood and affects mood during the day. For, you know, the kind of day-to-day emotional things that we may go through, but also there have been some interesting research on people who've been through trauma and how nightmares can actually, over time, be a way of kind of overcoming a really traumatic experience.
How can that be?
Well, when it works as it's supposed to, nightmares kind of go through a transition. It's one of the examples that I'd mentioned in the book is a woman who had been in New York City emerging from the subway by the World Trade Center immediately following the terrorist attacks and saw people jumping to their deaths from the towers. And those horrific images were replayed just as she had seen them for many nights afterward in her dreams. But after a few weeks, the dream transformed. And instead of watching helplessly, she supplied the people who were leaping from the buildings with parasols, these colorful parasols that allowed them to drift down to safety. And after that, her dreaming pattern returned to normal, and the whole trauma of all of that memory no longer dominated her thoughts during waking hours as it had been. So it's in the dreaming process, connections are made between the recent disturbing event and other positive experiences, and the disturbing emotions become less overwhelming. And finally, the trauma, when it works properly, is integrated as just one portion of life history rather than this dark cloud that's blotting out everything else.
What do we know about why some people remember their dreams on a regular basis, dream in color, hear music and voices, and others can barely remember what they dream? And even when they do, it's very two-dimensional, black and white.
There's not a whole lot of evidence about what distinguishes one from the other. There do seem to be differences in terms of dream recall. There are a few studies showing that people who are involved in the arts, and in particularly visual arts, seem to have more vivid dream recall. But the one thing that that was consistent is that people who are focusing on dreams, keeping a dream journal, and really as they're going to sleep, thinking about the intent to remember their dreams, do tend to have better dream recall. And, you know, over time, that does seem to be the one thing that can prompt more dream recall and more vivid dreaming. So, you know, that may be part of it, at least what we know for now.
I've gone in and out of phases where I keep little notes about what I dream, and invariably I think, okay, next time I wake up in the middle of the night, I'll write it down. I don't, and I kick myself the next morning because I can remember it right afterwards, but it fades.
Right, and it's usually, if you don't write it down immediately upon waking, it's not going to be encoded in your long-term memory. So
now there's some dreams I can remember from childhood.
Very
vividly.
Interesting, yeah. And are they ones that you that seem to have a recurring theme?
Yes. I dreamed I was Alice in Wonderland.
Wow, that's great.
It was really weird, but scary. It was a nightmare, and the older the older I became, the less nightmarish it felt.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the symbols that appear in our dreams, it really are personal. There's not a one-size-fits-all kind of dream interpretation.
Right.
And, you know, there are some common themes. The most commonly reported dream across all societies is one of being chased, and that may have something to do with the, you know, evolutionary origin of dreams, of being this, you know,
survival.
To rehearse survival information, important for survival when you're not having to, in waking life, avoid the speeding car or the tiger chasing you. So that's a common one, and our brains are very good at making visual metaphors to express an emotion. So, you know, that the dream that people have frequently about appearing in public naked, or an exam that they haven't studied showing up there, and it's an exam they haven't studied for, is, you know, a perfect metaphor for anxiety and, you know, those kind of emotions that get turned into visual metaphors.
Let's take a quick call before we go on break, Andrea. Let's see. Tom, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. I believe at one time I remember a theory on dreams that they could be affected by your eating habits. In other words, eating late at night just before you went to bed, or perhaps certain foods that you ate. I wonder if Ms. Rock could comment on that.
I've heard that theory, but in terms of the evidence that they, you know, of the scientists that I'd spoken to, it did not seem to play a factor. There are some medications that can affect dreaming as well, but that's the only thing in terms of something that you would ingest.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, thank you.
Thanks for the call, Tom. We're going to take a quick break, and Andrea, you'll return to us in the third segment of the program. I appreciate you hanging in there with us.
Great, thanks.
All righty, when we return, joining us, Robert Moss, author of Dream Gates, Exploring the Worlds of Soul, Imagination, and Life Beyond Death, and that's just one of the several books that he's written regarding dreams. He's also a journalist and novelist and speechwriter, from what I can gather. So when we return, Robert Moss will be with us, and hopefully you'll be with us as well with your questions and comments. 614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call. And if you want to email us, allsides@wosu.org, or go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. We welcome your questions and comments there as well. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Developed by WOSU Public Media and the Columbus Metropolitan Library, ColumbusNeighborhoods.org features more than 30 neighborhoods in and around the city. It allows users to tell their own stories, post their own photos and video, and contribute to the collective story of Columbus. To be a part of this multimedia public engagement project or to learn more, visit columbusneighborhoods.org. 79 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:21 this morning. A few clouds and a little sunshine today, also a slight chance of rain and a high of 90. A good chance of showers, maybe a thunderstorm this afternoon and into this evening. Otherwise, mostly cloudy and a low of 71 degrees. Mostly cloudy for Thursday and a high of 85. And partly cloudy Thursday night, a low of 63. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining us now is Robert Moss. He is a former lecturer in ancient history at the Australian National University, a best-selling author, journalist, and speechwriter. Robert also is the creator of Active Dreaming, a method for working with dreams and imagination. He's written several books on dreaming, including the recently re-released paperback edition of Dream Gates, Exploring the Worlds of Soul, Imagination, and Life Beyond Death. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Good to be with you, Ann.
Yeah, I want to play another cut from the movie Inception. In this scene from the movie, Cobb, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, teaches Ariadne, played by Ellen Page, about creating a dream world.
Well, dreams, they feel real while we're in them, right? It's only when we wake up that we realize something was actually strange. Let me ask you a question. You never really remember the beginning of a dream, do you? You always wind up right in the middle of what's going on.
I guess, yeah.
So how did we end up here?
Well, we just came from the,
Think about it, Ariadne. How did you get here? Where are you right now?
We're dreaming.
Creepy. Robert, could we be dreaming right now?
Well, from my point of view, we probably are. And one of my games is to look at everything that goes on in waking life as if it's a dream symbol or a sign and read things that way. I mean, traditional indigenous people don't separate working with sleep dreams from observing signs and coincidences in the world around them. So from that point of view, looking at the world around you as if it's a forest of living symbols looking at you, as Baudelaire said with the poet's clarity, is a great way to be. As far as the movie Inception is concerned, and I don't like the movie, by the way,
okay.
I reviewed it on my blog, the business of reality creation is not fiction. I mean, reality creation in the true world of imagination, for which the old name is the imaginal realm, Olam Hadimut in Hebrew, Olam Al-Mital in Arabic, two traditions that understand this very well. We can create things in a world of imagination, and they have their own reality. In Inception, this creation is just a mind trap, a sterile mind trap, producing those horrible vistas of endless vertical ice boxes. I mean, the paucity of visual imagination in the movie is amazing. And the Leonardo DiCaprio line about you don't remember the beginning of a dream is actually nonsense. You can learn to go consciously into the dream space and remember the whole thing from beginning to end. One of the techniques of active dreaming that I teach in practice, which goes far beyond what is called lucid dreaming. So we're talking now, Anne, about ancient methods of working with dreams. And by the way, they're practical. This isn't mystical New Age soap flake stuff, nor is it just science fiction. These are techniques our ancestors understood, and it's time for us to bring them back. And that's what I'm engaged in.
Are you finding a greater sense of acceptance and interest among people than you did back when, say, Dream Gates was first published, I think, in 1998?
Absolutely. Sometimes we have to wait for the world to catch up with us. The time for this book, Dream Gates, is now. I published it in 1998 for the first time. I've reissued it with a new introduction, which mm-hmm. invites people openly to become citizens of the multidimensional universe. And I think the world is ready for it. There's been a terrific response to it. Of course, this movie, Inception, though I dislike it, has created a terrific buzz about dreaming, and although you would be extremely misguided if you thought what was presented in the movie is in any way essential or, on the other hand, in any way purely science fiction, the movie has generated a discussion, which is interesting.
You know, it's interesting when you, the reference to Baudelaire, at when people who start seeing the world in terms of, what was the word you used, representing different things, It made me think about that connection between just dreaming and imagination.
Well, there is a connection.
Symbolism. I'm sorry. The word I was looking for was symbolism.
Well, symbols bring together what we know with what we do not already know. I mean, a symbol, literally in its Greek origin, remember I'm a former professor of ancient
history. I do, and boy, don't nail me too many times
to
me.
It's about bringing things together. Actually, the word symbol is very related to the word coincidence. One is from Greek, the other is from Latin. But both words have something to do with things, bringing things together or letting things fall together, letting things come up at the same time. Why am I saying that? Because we are talking about ways of understanding what the little everyday mind does not know. This is the great thing about dreaming, you see. Dreaming is not fundamentally about what goes on during sleep, despite all the Western psychology. Dreaming is fundamentally about waking up to an order of events beyond the obvious and working within that order and learning to read the patterns of what wants to happen in the world. This is an art that was highly valued throughout most of human history. As I write in my book, The Secret History of Dreaming, which is the first attempt to portray the central role of dreaming and imagination in the history of everything. And it's time for us to wake up to how this works. It can support our lives. It can help us get through. And, of course, it's a pathway to incredible fun and adventure.
Now, you had a fabulous career as an author, journalist. I think you wrote speeches for Margaret Thatcher. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. But how did you get to dreaming as a primary force in your life like this?
Well, it's where I started, Anne. As you can hear, I come from somewhere else. I was born in Australia, where the indigenous people, the Aborigines, teach that our personal dreams can give us access to the dream time, which is about more than the personal subconscious of Western psychology. The dream time is the real world in which the events and situations that manifest in waking life have their origin. The dream time is where you meet true teachers and mentors and the ancestors, and you get there, the Aborigines teach, quite often through your dreams. You also, in dreaming, the Aborigines believe, you get around, you go traveling, you visit other people, you encounter people, and this is all transpersonal. So I knew this by osmosis as a kid, but I also suffered the gift in the wound of being a terribly sick kid. We didn't have the word near-death experience in those days, but an Australian doctor said to my mother after I'd lost vital signs in a hospital age 9, oh, the poor kid, he died and came back. So I have known since childhood that there are real worlds beyond the physical one, which, by the way, is what physics today tells us, too. This isn't a fringe belief. And I've operated from that knowledge all my life. Now, I grew up in a conservative time in Australia in a military family, so I didn't run around talking about this stuff too much, at least not among adults.
You knew, even as a child, just don't talk about it.
Well, as a child, it was not safe to talk about it. But, you know, last time I went back to Melbourne, my birthplace, I had 600 people for a one-day workshop at a university, thrilled and excited to be discussing their dreams. So the society I grew up in has changed. Anyway, I'm a dreamer from way back. This is where I start. And in every phase of my life, I've used my dreaming to get through.
We've got a call right now, but I was wondering if you have a sense about why some people don't remember their dreams and other people, even people who don't keep journals and don't really work hard at it, dream all the time in Coda Color and Technicolor, I should say, and, remember things and learn from them.
Well, if we are suffering a dream drought, there are two principal reasons. First is that we don't have good habits in relation to dreaming. Typically, we don't make time or space when we wake up to catch our dreams. And when we wake up includes those drifty in-between periods in the middle of the night, the hypnagogic state in which so many good things are available. So we don't have a habit of catching and sharing dreams. And the method of sharing is all important. I've invented a new way of sharing dreams. It makes it safe and fun to talk about dreams to just about anyone and be guided towards effective action. The second reason a lot of us are missing out on our dreams is we kiss them goodbye, we blow them off, because either we are fearful that something seen in the dream will catch up with us, we'd rather not know about it, or secondly, we've been somewhere wonderful in our dreams, but on waking we think, gosh, I could never have Mr. Right or that dream home or that dream job, so we blow them away, forgetting that dreams show us possibilities for waking life.
Joining us now on the phone is John. John, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. How are you doing?
Good.
Hey, John.
I'm a first-time caller, and I'm blessed with the ability to lucid dream. It happens about maybe two or three times a week for me. And recently, I've been trying to direct my dreams in the direction of spirituality. I actually try to pray during my dreams. And I think that takes me closer to God and, the divine. And I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Well, John, I applaud your efforts to get closer to the God you can talk to in your dreams. And by the way, this is one thing understood in every religious tradition whose spiritual life is still active, that dreams give us direct access to the sacred, that they're a way of talking to the God we can talk to, that they take us to the spiritual realm. So in John's practice, he is following that of many people before them. My favorite author on dreams before the modern era was a bishop of the church in North Africa, Synesius of Cyrene, who around the year 400 said that dreams are our direct access to the sacred, and we should not allow anyone to come between us and that divine source. So when John approaches in lucid dreaming a divine source through prayer, he's doing something that all spiritual traditions that are alive have understood and wanted to do.
In the book and the part that I read, you briefly referred to lucid dreaming, and you likened it to the experiences of Robert Monroe. He's the author of Journeys Out of the Body, about astral projection. And I wonder, is all of that and shared dreaming and active dreaming, is it all part of the same thing?
Well, active dreaming goes far beyond lucid dreaming as it's being discussed in our society. Active dreaming, my approach, includes some of the lucid dreaming techniques, but the basic proposition, the basic practice of active dreaming is beyond lucid dreaming in this sense. First of all, we learn to enter the dream space with conscious intention. It's not just about waking up inside a sleep dream to the fact that you're dreaming. It's about learning to shift consciousness and go to real and interesting places in the imagination for healing and guidance. We can learn to do this as shared dreaming. I teach people to travel together with one or more partners into the dream space and do really good stuff. For example, you know, to get guidance on a crisis that may lie ahead, or to go to a place of healing from which the body can derive images that it can believe in. I mean, the version of this in shared dreaming is dark side and so limited and so sterile. We can learn to do shared dreaming for life supporting purposes. I also teach people to go back inside a dream through what I call dream reentry, and to have a partner travel with them inside their dream space through what I call tracking, to do something interesting, to dream the dream onward to healing and resolution. So these are techniques for wide awake, conscious, intentional, hyper-vivid dreaming. And as I say, this goes beyond approaches to lucid dreaming that are just about telling yourself in a sleep dream that you're lucid and you should pay attention and try and control everything.
Is the goal to be active always in your dreams, or is there some value in just letting your mind take you where it will?
Oh, absolutely there's value in letting your mind take you where you will. I mean, any attempt to control our dreams is dumb and self-limiting. Our dreams are wiser than we are. The everyday ego doesn't know very much. And one of the great functions of spontaneous sleep dreams, the ones we don't ask for in which we are not lucid, is they hold up a mirror to the actions and behavior of the everyday self, which can be embarrassing and can be part of course correction in life. So I'm absolutely not one of those who advocates controlling our dreams. I want to be in touch with a source that is wiser than I am, and that is one of the gifts of dreaming.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org to speak with Robert Moss. He's the author of the recently re-released Dreamgates, Exploring the Worlds of Soul, Imagination, and Life Beyond Death. And Todd, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I have heard a theory before that when you dream, you're playing all the parts in the dream. You're playing other characters, you're playing the house. If you're in a house, you're playing the sky. And frankly, I have not found that theory helpful when I think about my own dreams, but I was curious about your perspective.
Well, that's a good question. I like playing the game of asking what part of me is everything in the dream. And in my workshops, we often do dream theater, in which members of the workshop will play act all the roles in a dream, which, you know, follows the idea that everything is a part of the dreamer. It's an interesting game to play, but like you, I am dissatisfied with its application to many dreams which contain a different kind of content. For example, dreams are transpersonal as well as personal. This is the ancient belief, and it's my impression based on working with many thousands of dreams over many years. We get out there. We visit other people. We encounter other people that are not just aspects of ourselves. Guess what? We travel across time for real. We travel into other dimensions of reality for real. And to say that all of this rich activity in our dreams is simply about aspects of ourself is remarkably limiting and not in the end, not at the end of the analysis, helpful in understanding a vast variety of our dreams. So that's one of the games that I will play to ask what part of me is everything in the dream, but I'm not satisfied with it as a template for understanding a lot of dreams.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Todd. Robert, in the movie Inception that you don't like, people can get lost in their dreams within dreams. And I've had dreams within dreams. But can you really get lost? Can that happen in the way that you see it?
Well, let's put it this way. There are bad neighborhoods in the dream world,
okay,
and astral reality, just as there are bad neighborhoods in ordinary life. Okay. And if you are drawn by your desires or your agendas into a bad neighborhood, you can get into trouble. You can even get stuck. I mean, that part of the movie Inception is not unreal, not purely science fiction. I've written about mind traps, astral traps, constructed by people who knew what they were doing in various traditions. I mean, there are marvelous and interesting and accounts of this in Persian and Urdu literature, for example, about the creation of a talism, an enchanted realm, to ensnare and trap the mind of the intended target. So there's a pedigree for this kind of stuff, which may or may not have been understood by Christopher Nolan and the screenwriting team for Inception. So, I'm not one of those who says that all dreams come in the service of health and wholeness. All dreams can set as learning assignments from which we can gain, but difficult stuff can go on in the dream space, as in waking life, which is why if we're going to be smart and sensible about this, we need to learn some of the basics of psychic self-protection.
You know, we're going to be speaking after the next break with Andrea Rock. She wrote The Mind at Night, The New Science of How and Why We Dream, and she writes about how science is advanced a lot in proving, for lack of a better word, a lot of the elements that you talk about that a lot of people didn't used to believe in.
Well, I think science is beginning to catch up with some of this. I will note that the most important scientific data, truly scientific data, mm-hmm, on dreaming, comes from what is collected inside the dream space itself. Because knowledge is state-specific, you see. To know a thing, you must be on a level of reality and consciousness appropriate to that thing. And to truly know about dreaming, you have to do more than analyze it and study the behavior of the brain during sleep. You've got to go into dreaming, which is why the techniques of shared dreaming and active dreaming that I teach are, I think, remarkably heuristic. I mean, remarkably helpful in advancing our true scientific understanding of dreaming. For example, if you can have several people go together in the dream space and explore the possibility of parallel universes, an area of consummate concern to current physics, you might bring back results that will be very interesting to science and propel our science further. And I have quantum physicists and microbiologists in my dream workshops, and there's a great deal of interest among some scientists that I know in having experiential knowledge to back their speculation.
So when you're talking about physics, what is the difference between dreaming and the physical world? I sort of kicked off the interview with, could we be dreaming right now? But
Well, if you follow superstring theory, then you are open to the idea that there are six or seven dimensions of the physical universe that are hidden to any instrumentation and ordinary sensory perception that we have. That is a popular theory in physics today. How would you know about that beyond speculation? Well, maybe you could know about it by going there. Maybe one of the things that goes on in dreaming is that we travel to those hidden dimensions of the physical universe which science is talking about. What's wrong with the idea of exploring that consciously as a way of pushing out the frontiers of our science and giving us an experiential way of understanding the speculations of our physicists?
In your opinion, why do some people completely disbelieve you and think it's a bunch of hooey and that it's spacey and weird?
Well, it would be because they have...
Because everybody dreams.
It's because they've closed themselves to their own experience. I mean, everybody dreams. I mean, right. Even the most conservative, physiologically oriented dream or sleep researcher will tell you that judging by the behavior of the brain waves, judging by the behavior of the eyeballs under closed eyelids, judging by chemical washes in the brain during sleep, everyone has images and mentation, a thinking process during the night. So if you're not remembering your own dreams, you are shut off from a dimension of wonder and entertainment and education, which most people, for most of our evolution on this planet, have thought is very important. The Iroquois Indians, who I got to know because of my dreams, I speak some Mohawk because of my dreams, the Iroquois Indian tradition of the Northeast says that if you are not in touch with your dreams, you've lost part of your soul. That's an interesting traditional way of looking at it. I think it is like that. I think some of us, as Jung observed, have lost touch with our soul, and that is partly because we've lost contact with the worlds of dreaming.
We're going to return with Robert Moss, author of Dream Gates, Exploring the Worlds of Soul, Imagination, and Life Beyond Death, and also Andrea Rock. She is the author of The Mind at Night, The New Science of How and Why We Dream. Welcome your questions and comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is Terry Gross, and I have about 15 seconds to explain why you should listen to Fresh Air. You should listen because, unlike this little promo, on Fresh Air we have time. Time to spend with incredibly interesting people in the arts, entertainment, and politics. Enough time that we get to know them. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon. On today's edition of Fresh Air, a lobbyist for the organization National Association of Evangelicals was forced to resign after comments he made on Fresh Air in support of gay unions. A discussion about how his life has changed begins at noon on Fresh Air, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. And you can see the new lineup of public affairs programming Friday nights from WOSU TV. Starting at 8 is Washington Week, followed by Columbus on the Record at 8:30. Continuing at 9 is the McLaughlin Group, and at 9:30, PBS presents a new show called Need to Know. It's an innovative program with a broadcast and web approach to news gathering and reporting. Watch the new public affairs lineup every Friday night beginning at 8 on WOSU TV. And it's 80 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:42 this morning. A few clouds, a little sunshine, and a slight chance of rain this afternoon, a high of 90. A good chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight, otherwise mostly cloudy, and a low of 71. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Both joining us now, Robert Moss, former lecturer in ancient history at the Australian National University, a best-selling author, journalist, and speechwriter. Robert, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you, Terry. Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
And Andrea Rock, science journalist and author of The Mind at Night. Andrea, your book, The Mind at Night, was published in 2004. Have you noticed, even in the last 6 years, any changes in society's acceptance of these new found scientific discoveries?
Well, I think it kind of comes and goes. It, you know, as Robert says, you know, the current film is certainly stimulating thought about this now, and you know, the kind of thing he does with the workshops and so on, certainly I think can help charge people's interest. But I think there is still kind of a widespread reluctance to take dreams seriously or to really understand the importance of what is happening in your brain when you're offline. And it can be just as important as what happens or more so than in waking consciousness. I also, sort of in line with what Robert's saying, I found it fascinating to talk to people about the dreams of the blind, someone I had spoken to who lost his sight at the age of 25 says that it's only after if he's learning a new route to walk somewhere or something, a new skill, it's only after he's dreamed about it that he's then able to, you know, confidently do whatever the new thing is in waking life. So I think we have to learn to give greater value to what is going on
That's a very interesting last story, Andrea. Let me just contribute something that is changing our society in relation to dreams profoundly and now at increasing speed. It is the growth of dream-sharing groups using methods that are fun, enlivening, and active. The New York Times said recently that the dream group is the new book club in the sense that lots of people are getting together to share dreams. Let me note, in order for that to be effective and become a truly popular movement, and I think it is becoming a truly popular movement, we have needed techniques that make it fun, entertaining to share dreams, get non-intrusive feedback, and be guided to action. I've invented the Lightning Dreamwork process, which folds in a protocol invented by Monty Allman, a clinical psychiatrist in New York, which requires us to always say in commenting on a dream or a life matter, if it were my dream or if it were my life, and not take the dreamer's power away by imposing an interpretation on them. My approach always ends with an action plan. What are you going to do to honor this dream? You're going to hit Google. Are you going to wear the color red? You're going to call him up. You're going to check out whether that road accident is going to happen next Tuesday at a certain intersection. So the big change that is taking place is not due to the buzz over Inception, although that's interesting, or anything of that evanescent nature. What is going on is a groundswell in our society is that dreamers everywhere are coming together in clubs, in dream-sharing groups, in circles, and learning to tell their dreams and get fun and entertainment and guidance from them. In this sense, the United States is at the, in the vanguard of dreaming in the world, because it is here in North America that the dreamwork movement has emerged with the banner that dreams belong to the dreamers, not to some tenured clerisy of analysts or experts. This is huge.
614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call and speak with Andrea Rock and Robert Moss. Dale, you're on the air. Your mother had premonitions in her dreams.
Well, that's what she said, the way she described it.
Okay.
They were not, she was not asleep. Okay. And sadly, and I had to understand this because it turned out to be real, she would have these awake. She called them premonitions. She was a very enlightened woman. And they were always about death. Her father worked at a funeral home, and when she would have these, someone would come to her who had passed and try to have her take her up to a casket to understand and accept what was going to happen, but she could never, you know, go up there and see whoever's in there. But she was never, never wrong. And the one, it depended on intensity. If it was a mild one, it was like a distant cousin or something. But when my father died, it was very intense. Actually, she was getting a newspaper in February and reached out and had it during there, and the whole house got really cold. I accepted that as a fact. You know, it was what it was. Now, a couple years ago, I lost my wife, and I believe we have one of the greatest love stories of all time. And I very, very much wanted to see her in my dreams, and it didn't happen. But recently, she'd been there, but it's not like I said, you know, hey, you know, how you doing? It's like she was like almost a matter of fact in my dream.
Just there. What do you make of the difference between these premonitions, or is there a difference between the premonitions and dreams?
Well, let me make a couple of quick comments around this, and thank you for sharing those moving family experiences, Dale. We do have access to the future. We can see into the future through premonition or preview, waking or sleeping in dreams or in intuitive states. So one of the things to know about this is if we can see the future, we might be able to do something useful with that information. Sometimes we can change the future because our dreams or impressions can be rehearsals for events that may not have to take place if we take appropriate action. Sometimes we see a future, a death in the family, for example, which is going to be played out because that's what life is like. But the dream can help us prepare for that, to help everybody deal with unfinished business, for example, to help the one who's embarking on the big journey to take off and go off on that journey well. So this is what is available to us. As far as dreaming of a departed loved one is concerned, well, sometimes for a while they don't show up in our dreams, and then later on they do. And if they're not showing up in our dreams, here's something we can always do. We can sit down quietly, put out something that is a remembrance of them, a souvenir of them, maybe put out something they would like to eat or drink, and imagine that we are having a loving conversation with them, dealing with whatever needs to be dealt with. This can be terribly healing. One of the things to know about the relationship between dreams and the departed is that healing and forgiveness and love are always available beyond the apparent barrier of death, and it is through dreaming that throughout history most humans have acquired their knowledge of the soul's survival of death. So this is hugely important stuff.
Dale, thanks for your call. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Take care. 614-292-8513. Lynn, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I wanted to share an experience I had back when I was in high school and ask if this fits into a certain category of experience. I had a dream one night that a friend of mine came home after a long trip. She was on a long trip. And then I woke up and realized I had been dreaming. But then I went into another level and realized that I only dreamed I had woken up, and I was still dreaming. And this continued through several levels of dreaming, waking, really realizing I was still dreaming. Then in the morning, I finally actually did wake up. Every single dream was that my friend had come home. When I finally woke up in the morning, I didn't know if she really had come home and I had dreamt about it, or I only dreamed she had come home. I was really confused. I knew it was a really powerful series of dreams. And then I looked at the calendar and realized, oh, no, she hadn't come home because she wasn't due for another month. Well, that night at dinner, I was sitting at the table with my family, and the doorbell rang. And my mother tells me the fork dropped out of my hand, my face turned ghost white, and I said, Linda's come back. And sure enough, it was Linda at the door. She really did come home that night.
Okay. Huh. Thanks, Lynn. Two comments about
this. Thank you, Lynn.
First of all, the Hawaiians, who have a rich vocabulary for dreaming, talk about the straight-up dream, the dream that shows you things exactly as they are or exactly as they will be in external reality. If this is my dream, I'm thinking I had a straight-up dream. It showed me what was going on with my friend, which was not on the calendar, but was going on in the external world, because in dreams we get around and we see things going on in the world around us. Secondly, the experience of waking up from multiple dreams. Sometimes people talk about false awakenings. That's a rather limited phrase, but we'll use it for now. Lynn, the best example of this I've ever heard, I've had many experiences of this myself, but the best experience of this I've ever heard was from a 12-year-old girl in a school program I was leading, my Talented and Gifted School Kids program, who described in exceptional, beautiful detail going through seven courtyards of dreaming, to one dream inside another, to the deepest and most vivid and most important dream, and then traveling back upwards through the seven levels of dreaming, remembering it all. Hey, in Inception, they only do three or four levels of dreaming. Here's a high school kid doing seven and describing her return from them. So that is an education in what's possible in dreaming. And by the way, the real experts on dreams are kids. They're children. They live closer to dreaming and imagination than most adults, and they're the people we should be listening to as we are listening to Lynn remembering what her high school self understood about dreams.
Andrea, do the researchers see differences when people are dreaming at different levels like that?
There hasn't been as much research looking at dream content in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But with children, as Robert says, it's quite interesting to look at the dreams of children and how they evolve. And I think there is a much closer connection and ability to accept dream life as real with kids.
As really real.
Yeah, and that their dream reports are very vivid and that they're willing to kind of accept wisdom from the dream or learn a lesson from the dream that adults may be more apt to dismiss.
We have an email from a listener. This is from James. How common is it to confuse dreams with reality? Which kind of goes to the last person's caller. I thought I dreamed seeing a coworker in the hospital where we work, walking around with a hospital gown and IV pole. She reminded me it actually had happened. How embarrassing. So it cuts both ways?
Well, you could say that. Dreams may be a corrective to a lot of our consensual hallucinations, you know. In other words, dreaming may wake us up to reality beyond the obvious. You know, in waking life, we're often like sleepwalkers going through a set of requirements and schedules, forgetting who we are, where we come from, and what it's all about. One of the gifts of dreaming, whether it's a sleep dream or a big-time coincidence that shakes you awake, is that it brings us alive to a deeper order of meaning and performance and importance. It can put us in touch with our bigger story, and there's such power and healing in being in touch with the sense of a bigger story. It can restore our inner compass. So I would say that we may be confusing ordinary experience with reality, and dreams may be showing us from time to time what the real reality is all about.
We have an email from a listener asking Andrea to talk about this. I have experienced an incident where I always knew where my brother was located after having dreamt of him that the evening before. This was confirmed when I would call him at his location. He was really upset when I told him his wife was pregnant and he hadn't told anyone yet. It turned out that he was later diagnosed with a non-malignant brain tumor, which was successfully removed. I have not dreamt of him since his operation. Have the effects of illness on dreaming ever been studied?
I haven't seen effects of illness. You know, as I said, the certain pharmaceuticals, obviously.
Yeah, I know of one, by the way.
Yeah.
I won't say it on air.
But I don't know, Robert, have you?
Well, I've written extensively about diagnostic dreams, for example. I mean, one thing's going on in dreaming is they show us what's going on inside the body, sometimes before symptoms are detected, and we can use that information. This was understood by Galen, the second most famous physician in the evolution of Western medicine. Galen, who's a rationalist, pragmatic doctor, said that during the night, consciousness, psyche, travels around inside the body, seeing what's going on there. I've assembled a database of more than 1,000 documented examples of dream diagnosis, in which in dreams the dreamer has seen something that is developing in the body before it manifests. One of my favorite stories told in my book, The Three Only Things, about this is about a woman whose doctors could not agree on her diagnosis. Then she dreamed that a wolf appeared to her in the night and said, "My name is Lupus Wolf. Tell the doctors." She told the doctors, they scrambled, they agreed it might be lupus, they based their treatment plan on that diagnosis, which proved to be accurate, and then something even better happened. Then the dreamer dreamed that the wolf appeared again as an ally to help her, as an imaginal helper in healing. So the connection between illness, wellness, and dreaming is immense. Dreaming is medicine. It shows us things that might be going wrong in the body, it shows us how to stay well, and when we get sick, it gives us images for self-healing.
And also, I think on the psychological front, I mean, there was an example that I had from a woman who was she was ending a marriage with a domineering husband. At the same time, she was having troubles with a coworker, a male coworker, who was showing her no respect and as she put it, walking all over her. And so when she has a dream one night that her ex-husband is coming into her new apartment wearing muddy shoes and ruining her white carpet. And then she, in a subsequent dream, as a victim, in the subsequent dream, she found she is on an elevator platform with no walls and rising through the air and is very terrified. But in the dream, she decided to stand up. And as soon as she did, the elevator walls came up securely. And when she woke, she realized that the message in her dream was that she needed to stand up for herself, and that was the important message from the dream, and it was a life-changing one for her.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And, of course, when the elevator walls came up, she was shielded. She was psychically shielded from the intrusions of her ex. And that image of him stomping through on her rug with muddy boots is a very powerful one and reminds us that, you know, when we end a relationship, it's not necessarily ended on emotional, psychological, or psychic levels. Sometimes, as with the elevator walls coming up, we need to put up a shield or screen so that the ex isn't haunting us.
I am really sorry that we can't get to all the calls that are waiting. I know a lot of good questions and comments out there. I just want to say thanks to Robert Moss, author of Dream Gates, Exploring the Worlds of Soul, Imagination, and Life Beyond Death. It's being re-released in paperback. Robert, thank you very much.
A pleasure. May your best dreams come true, Anne.
Thank you. And Andrea Rock, author of The Mind at Night, The New Science of How and Why We Dream. Andrea, glad you could join us today.
Thanks so much. It was fun.
Thanks. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820, Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820, NPR News.